You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iWoka.co.uk. Today we're in Maritime.
Happy rest day, Lionel and Francois.
Thank you, Richard. It's been lovely, hasn't it? We've been for a bike ride to Ile de Ré. We've absolutely all over the Strava leaderboards today, aren't you?
Dominating it.
I beat Warren Barguil up a climb today on Strava. This is this equals my finest achievement as a cyclist.
That's over the bridge that the riders will go over tomorrow onto Ile de Ré from La Rochelle. A very sort of spectacular bridge. It'll look great, I'm sure, in the pictures. But Lionel, I mean, pudding power.
I was going to say,
something fly up there.
Equaling my finest ever achievement in cycling, which I was going to joke was being selected for Scotland in the Commonwealth Games, but there's no way I'm going to offend you.
This betters that. I was actually quickest over the bridge today. The names lining up behind me, some of the finest in the Tour de France. We've got Connor Swift, winner Anacona, Warren Barguil, Tom Van Asbroek, Tim de Klerk beat him as well. Yeah, a good day. I don't think those guys were taking it easy either. I think they were going pretty hard.
I reckon they'll be going a bit quicker tomorrow, though, when the Tour de France stage 10 goes over the bridge and then finishes with a sprint, we think, in Ile de Ré.
Well, we'll still be faster than these guys, you know, in the car.
Yeah, true. So, someone accused me of leaving my Strava on in the car. Not the case at all. I meant to open this podcast by welcoming you to our daily Tirreno Adriatico coverage.
Wow, it's so strange, isn't it? Keeping an eye on Tirreno while
the cycling
on.
Calendar. We've always said it's brilliantly designed, and this year is fantastic. The way they've had Tirreno Adriatico open start on the first rest day of the tour. It's just the thinking that's going on.
We don't have any audio diaries from Tirreno Adriatico.
We don't. A thrilling sprint finish there. Have you got the tale of the...
Pascal Ackermann won.
No. Pascal Ackermann, a great sprint by him. Arguably, as strong a sprinting field there as there is here, you could say. And, that's a subject we'll cover in our episode of Kilometre Zero later this week. But this is our press conference episode, the first of two during this Tour de France on the rest days when we answer your questions. Without further ado, let's hear the first one.
Hi, Richard, Lionel and Francois. This is Chris Lund from Newquay in Cornwall. I'm just out walking the dog, which is when I listen to your guys' podcast, which is brilliant. Thank you, by the way. My question is directed more at Francois, really. I just wondered, is he a bike rider? Are you a bike rider, Francois? If so, to what level and kind of bike do you ride? Just be really interested. If you're not a bike rider, do you do anything other sports? Thanks, and keep up the good work, guys. Cheers.
Thanks for that, Chris. Out walking your dog. We're big fans of the Adam Buxton podcast, aren't we, Lionel? He opens his podcast out walking the dog. And you do a wonderful impression of Rosie the dog, don't you?
I do, Richard, yeah. Sounds a bit like Alex Dowsett.
Well, your Alex Dowsett impression sounds like Rosie the dog. Anyway, it's a question for you, Francois.
Well, walking the dog would be the most sports I'd do if I had a dog. So like Winston Churchill, no sports. Well, it's not entirely true. I never was a rider. It's funny because I always was a cycling fan from my youth, but I kind of didn't. I was a runner, not long distance. I was 850-meter runner. If you want to know how fast I went, I was about 1:56 for 800.
Decent.
Which is decent. Yeah, I was. My distance was actually the kilometer. I was very good. You know, over 1,000 meters, but it's not a race you do. Well, you do in the small categories actually run the 1,000 meters, but so well 800, 1,500. I did lots of cross country and stuff, but you know, as soon as it went over 4.5 k's, I'm not an endurance man. That's maybe why I didn't like riding that much, and also I don't think I had the build. I was also a swimmer, breaststroke, very good at the age of 14. By that, you know. What was my time? 1:14, I think, on 100 meters breaststroke when I was a teenager. And I was also a high jumper, 1:75, if you want to know everything. But so I don't think I had to be. I was too light, too tall and not strong enough to be a good rider. I tried quite a few times with friends, you know, with bikes, and I don't know, I couldn't find the right position on the bike. Later in life, I loved mountain biking quite a bit, because you just have fun, you know, going down, well, like, you know, because actually mountain bike is a lot like alpine skiing. You stand on the pedals and you go down and try not to crash. That's mainly the way I saw mountain biking personally. So now, oddly enough, I have a standing bike at bike at home, you know, to practice when I do some of the work on my computer, and I kind of ride not very far, you know, obviously on this bike for like half an hour a day. By the look at the watts on my my screen, I'm not doing too well. But
you're
I
not
mean,
gonna trouble the Strava leaderboard.
No, I don't think so.
Pont de Ray.
I was just going to ask Francois whether maybe boule or petanque would be your sport now, because there was an incident in Marseille, wasn't there?
The Belgians came down
to Marseille for a big tournament, beat the Marseille team 13-1, and then got beaten up.
That's right. Well, it was not the Marseille team, because the tournament you're referring to, you've got 3,000 teams that, you know, three competing in this kinds of world championships of pétanque. So it was a Marseille team, but it would take me hours to discuss the strange rules and the strange customs of pétanque. But I mean, you know, how could I say, beatings and riots and scruffles and corruption and gangsterism are part of the game more often than not. So, but it would take an whole episode to discuss that. So
we haven't got time for that. Let's crack on with our next cycling questions.
Hi, chaps. John here from Eurosport. Loving the pod as ever. Really, really fantastic. Daily listening, and it's keeping me very amused, and particularly enjoyed the Defying Gravity pod with Lionel. My question is about sports psychology, and on this tour, from lots of the excellent audio diaries, hearing about the fact that the guys are in single rooms because of COVID. And I just wondered how much time was spent preparing them for this and existing on their own, and just how much time they've spent talking to sports psychologists about dealing with that solitary confinement that they're going to be going through for much of this tour. Cheers.
Well, it's a familiar voice, isn't it? John Harris Bass, you'll hear him on the Eurosport coverage. Thanks for your question, John. It's an interesting one, not just at the tour. I spoke to a rider a couple of weeks before the tour who was hoping that he wouldn't be picked for the tour because they are in such restricted bubbles and have been in the weeks leading up to the race that a lot of them, I think, are finding it quite tough. And I know on one team where they were having them in single rooms, a couple of riders didn't want to be in single rooms because they're so used to sharing. And it's not the case that all the teams are in single rooms. I know NTT and Bora Hansgrohe are doing the usual thing of having riders share rooms. But a lot of teams are having them in single rooms. And in those cases, sometimes they're not all in the same hotel. You know, but I think it's more than the restrictions are more restrictive than just at this Tour de France. I think in the period leading up to it, riders have been in these bubbles and very limited in what they can do.
Yeah, this is a question that came up when I was talking to Mitch Docker earlier for this week's Life in the Peloton, which will be out on Wednesday. And he said that during the recent race block he did, which was Strada Bianca to Milan San Remo, the riders were in individual rooms, and it meant that they spent more time all together at the dinner table, and they chatted around the dinner table longer after dinner. They actually played cards a couple of nights, and the reason for that was because once they went back to their room, they were on their own with Netflix, and that was that. So perhaps it had a positive benefit to team morale, just getting everyone together rather than just the riders splitting off into their roommate pairs. So I'm sure some people would like it and some people wouldn't. The interesting thing will be what happens when things return to normal and there isn't a reason to have single rooms.
If I can break into that, what you said returns to normal. The question, you know, from I like his historical point of view, when did it start, the rule of two per room? Because in the we know for sure that in the 1970s and earlier, they were actually sometimes sleeping in dormitories and all together in the same room. So when I think the as far as I remember, I think the two riders per room kind of rule was set up to save a little bit of money on hotels in the probably in the mid or late 70s. It's not so old. So is it normal? Why? I mean, riders have gone used to it, but I mean, why in the first? Why should they share?
Well, the dormitories survived until certainly the mid to late 80s. I mean, Malcolm Elliott, Sean Kelly both talk about maybe 20, 30 riders in some kind of
school,
or in particularly in the mountains and probably more so in the Pyrenees, like some sort of an outward bound type center where school trips go to. And so yeah, it must be pretty off-putting. You put all the sprinters in one room and all the climbers in another dorm. I mean, I don't know how it worked.
They used to all eat together as well. I mean, the old tour caravan, when you read the stories from the 1920s and 1930s, they were all having dinner together in a hotel with the tour direction. Well, of course, wine was on the table. So it's kind of new, this tour. I think my impression is because ASO staff, they still share rooms as well. My impression is that a rule probably set by Félix Lévitin, I think it was around that time, was that, since everybody involved in the tour caravan should share rooms, like a big traveling holiday camp or something, and also saving money. I think that's the only reason why.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a small business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to iWalker, our title sponsor. We are extremely grateful to them. They are helping us be on the road covering the Tour de France. Currently in La Rochelle, aren't we? I don't think we said where we were at the start of the episode, but we're in La Rochelle for 3 nights. And if you've run a small business and you'd like to know more about what iWalker can do for you, go to iwalker.co.uk. Next question, please.
Hello, Richard, Lionel, Francois. This is a question coming from Stuart from Newport, Rhode Island. Listen to you guys all the time on some of my morning rides. Really make the time go quickly. I have a question for you relating to the recent success of Wout Van Aert. And I'm wondering if this puts maybe a different spin on the career paths picked particularly by Wout and his cyclocross rival, Mathieu van der Poel. At the time, they sort of made their choices with Wout going to an established team and van der Poel maybe going to a smaller team where he could be a bigger fish. It seemed that van der Poel might be making the stronger choice, the bolder choice. But now, as he watches from the sidelines and Wout van Aert racks up major victories, I'm wondering if maybe that decision doesn't look so good in hindsight. Anyway, really curious to hear what you think about those two guys and what their future prospects are, both in terms of their team choices and sort of their success on the Grand Tour level. Thanks again. Keep up the great work. I look forward to listening to more down the road.
I mean, one thing I would say about Wout van Aert is that being in the team that he's in, and when he joined that team at the start of last year, they weren't even then the team that they are now. In a way, they've improved. The riders have improved. They've improved as a collective. But watching him win the two sprint stages that he's won, I've been watching that thinking there's no pressure on him there. There's no. I was watching Mathieu van der Poel today at the finale of Tirreno Adriatico, and that team, and I remember we did an episode about Mathieu van der Poel earlier this year, a big interview with his father, Adrie van der Poel, and I spoke to a Belgian journalist who said that his team is basically Molteni reinvented. It's a team built around one rider, and the pressure is all on him. He is the talisman. He carries that team. And so that does put pressure on him, and whether by accident or design, Wout van Aert is in a setup where there isn't that same pressure. There are certain races, of course, where he is the leader and where he's expected to win. But I just thought he's raced here like a man without anybody expecting anything of him, with a sort of a freedom, a kind of sense of liberty.
Yeah, because the team he's in, Jumbo-Visma, if he won Milan-San Remo, But then the question after that is not, okay, you've done that, now what? He's able to settle into a team support role here, whereas Mathieu van der Poel doesn't even get a guaranteed start in all of the biggest races, which, because the team isn't World Tour level, and so the pressure is magnified when he gets the opportunity in the biggest races. And that, in its very nature, by reducing the chances to win at the top level, it increases the pressure when he is on the start line at a World Tour race. And then it's all on his shoulders. It's not like there's anyone else in the team really who's going to deliver that level of victory. So, yeah, completely chalk and cheese situations for the two riders. And I mean, you would think that Mathieu van der Poel would probably benefit from being in Wout van Aert's position more than Wout van Aert would benefit from being in van der Poel's position.
I think there are two mistakes to make when you start your career as a young rider, is to sign for too good a team like Dakonin Quickstep and Remco Evenepoel, because in this case you're not always the priority, you know, in any type of race. And the other mistake is to sign for, you know, too bad or too low a team, because in this case, as you said, you're not entitled to take part in all the World Tour races. In the same time, all the pressure is on you. So to sign for a middle of the table team is probably the best move when you're a young up and coming rider, because once you start delivering, you can go to the higher richer team. Where we've all thought, you know, Mathieu van der Poel, the decision to stick with his original team was maybe a mistake, and Van Aert is probably in the ideal position, that, as you said, you know, no pressure because everything relies on him, and no pressure because there are other priorities in the team. There are other priorities for Jumbo-Visma, but as we saw, well, and in the case of Van Aert, is actually in a position apparently to be some kind of a priority in any kind of terrain. So yeah, obviously he made the best choice.
I mean, yeah, let's not be too hasty, however, in writing off Mathieu van der Poel, because as we discussed in that episode of this year, he also wants to race mountain biking, you know, and he wouldn't be able to do that in a lot of World Tour teams, or maybe in any World Tour teams.
Well, you're not allowed to ride a mountain bike in the Tour de France.
Yeah, we've seen, I mean, a comparable case is actually Tom Pidcock, who's just won the Baby Giro. Mm. And he's, you know, he's delayed turning professional or World Tour team in order to do other things and enjoy himself. And what's wrong with that? You know, Mathieu van der Poel wants to go to the Olympic Games and ride the mountain bike race, as well as riding as many of the top road races as he can. And it's far too early to sort of say that he's made the wrong decision, I think.
And without piling all the sort of pressure onto Peter Sagan, you know, Peter Sagan is 30 now and starting to look a little bit like he's the fire's gone out a little bit. He doesn't look the same sparky character that he was even 2-3 years ago. We know he's supposed to be starting the Giro d'Italia. That's an awful lot of Grand Tour racing back to back with only a couple of weeks off, and you've got to assume that he's going to do the World Championships in between. So a heavy old schedule for him. But you know, he doesn't look like a rider who's having fun, and that may be a consequence of being so good so young and kind of, you know, having the pressure on his shoulders for, well, getting on for a decade now.
Richard, Lionel and Francois. It's Timo from Germany, friend of the podcast, of course. And I have a question to the tactic of Jumbo-Visma today on the eighth stage, because Dumoulin was working for Roglic on the last climb of the stage. And I wondered if it would be a better tactic to let Dumoulin attack than it would be on the other guys like Bernal and Pogacar to really chase him down. If it worked, Dumoulin could take the yellow jersey or could take some time on the others. And if it didn't work, Roglic could go on a counterattack. So they decided to let Dumoulin work for Roglic, and it didn't really pay off. I wondered if this was the right tactic, because now we have just Roglic on the GC and Dumoulin is down on the GC. So if Roglic crash, they are out of the GC battle for this year. And yeah, I thought there would be some better tactics to go on.
Thanks for the question, Timo, and great to hear that you're listening to the podcast there in Germany. I'm always sort of loath to sit here and say that somebody got the tactics wrong or should have done this or should have done that, because I think Tom Dumoulin knew what kind of legs he had and what he was capable of. I think that, I mean, we were talking earlier about Wout van Aert and the freedom that not having all the pressure on him affords him. And I think that can be also a curse as well as a blessing. Because if Tom Dumoulin had been riding as a sole GC leader for Sunweb or somebody, he'd have been forced to be a lot more canny and cagey and not have to make that decision to effectively sacrifice himself for Roglic. And he would have sat there and, you know, it's a long race. It's 3 weeks long. And in the third week, Dumoulin might find that others are more tired than he is. He obviously doesn't feel at the moment that he's going to be able to contend for the victory in this tour. But I am tempted to agree with your analysis that if you've got the matches to burn to put in that kind of acceleration at the front of the group, why not spend them instead on an attack? Now, Tom Dumoulin, if you're listening, will probably say, well, I didn't have the legs to attack. I would have just looked silly, or I wouldn't have got anywhere at all. And he's not an explosive sort of rider. You know, I remember the Giro d'Italia that he finished second to Chris Froome, and you know, the day after Froome's great escape, Dumoulin was still in the race, and we were looking forward that day to Dumoulin really, you know, fighting to try and get the pink jersey back. And he's not the sort of rider that's going to launch kind of Mikel Landa style attacks on steep climbs at all, so it's maybe not in his skill set. But yeah, I mean, I'm sympathetic to what you say.
Hello, chaps. I wanted to ask you about the little piece of audio from Seb Piquet that you play when it's time to hear a message from one of the sponsors, because you've been using it for a while, but I don't think I've ever heard the origin story behind it, and that has allowed my imagination to fill in the gaps. For me, I love thinking about Napalm, deciding to give Richard the day off, and taking the driver's seat for that stage, but in a moment of distraction, maybe a cornichon falling in his lap from the sandwich he's eating for lunch, he gets too close and accidentally clips the back wheel of Thibaut Pinot, who's trying to make his way back to the bunch after a puncture, causing a chain reaction crash that takes the French favorite out of the race for yet another year. So tell me, how close am I? Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Well, in terms of the translation of what Seb says, Francois...
It means, well, shoot au peloton.
Crash.
It means crash in the peloton. It's very simple.
Cycling podcast.
It doesn't mean please shut up while I'm talking or something. It's just crash. Yeah, crash. And there's a funny thing, because the former speakers didn't use the same words. And when Seb came on the scene as the tour speaker, he had this famous phrase that made everybody laugh, and it was Radio Shack at the back of the pack, Radio Shack at the back of the pack. And so it was kind of a little rhyme, you know, his little own little motto in a way. And so it's so at the back of the pack remained kind of Seb's trademark.
Well, Seb, I should say that we were looking for a voice to introduce the adverts that we play in the podcast, to have a little break, a little wall between the editorial content and the advertising content. And I just asked Seb, if his voice is so familiar to us, it's the voice of bike racing now, and I thought his voice would be perfect in that slot. So I asked him to come up to, he sent in a few suggested phrases, and that was the one we liked.
And just to clarify who Seb Piquet is, he is the voice of Radio Tour, as we always say. He sits in the passenger seat in the front of the basically the chief commissaire race director's car, and he is the eyes, and he's looking out for anyone who has a puncture or a crash, or a rider puts his arm up in the air, and then he's relaying that message that the team cars behind need to come up the convoy to service or help out, offer assistance to the riders. So that's the voice. Seb Piquet's voice is the one that is in every team car. That's who the sports directors are listening to. He's giving out the time gaps. He's giving out the race numbers of who's in the breakaway. He's basically keeping the entire tour show on the road day in, day out. And, well, let's hear from him.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France. Remind us to tell you that our coverage here is sponsored by the Watt Bike Atom. In this episode, we're going to hear from a Watt biker called Robert Ramsden Board, who has never actually owned a road bike. He used to be a regular mountain biker, but in the past year, the Watt Bike Atom has become a huge part of his life, helping him to lose weight, get fit, and meet a community of cyclists on Zwift.
My cycling journey is sort of one where I got to a good level with my mountain biking, you know, to the point where I was doing some events and enjoying myself getting muddy. But then, say, I had this sort of hiatus where I didn't didn't cycle, and the Watt bikes got me back into it, albeit in a virtual world rather than a physical one. And I still have yet to own a real life road bike in my adult life. So my journey really was one of sort of a personal journey to try and get fit. I started using Zwift a bit on a treadmill, and then very quickly wanted to transition to the cycling side of things. And I wanted something that would be comfortable and good place for me to spend a reasonable amount of time. I think that's quite important with these products. When it arrived, I thought I would be having a relatively solo journey to fitness, and I would just be sort of sat on this thing, pedaling away, and I hoped that I would, you know, find solace in Netflix to keep me from getting bored. And in fact, total opposite has happened. I've used it to hook up to the online platform Zwift. I'm now part of a social community on there, which has transformed the training for me. I use the group ride function, so I have a significant amount of rides that I do that are with people all over the world, some of whom I sort of virtually know now, and we've hooked up on social media. So far from it being a solo platform at home that you're sort of heading away just on your own, quite the opposite. It's been transformational in terms of the experience with it. It keeps you coming back. And, I saw the numbers drop, and I was dropping a kilo a week, and I thought, well, this is working. So if it's not broke, don't fix it. So I'm down about 20 plus kilos now. Yeah, I'm fitter and healthier than I've been in a long time. And mentally, that makes you feel good, right? When you have to buy new clothes because you've got too small for the old ones, that's quite a cool feeling, actually. So, yeah, it's been great.
If you'd like to check out the Wattbike Atom, go to wattbike.com, WATTBIKE.com. You can buy one now from £90 per month.
Hi guys, my name is Will Whitmore and I live in Mercersburg, Pennsylvania. While I've been watching the early part of the tour this year, like many, I'm struck by the lack of crowds. But I was wondering, is a lack of crowds on mountains changing how the tour is raced? There are no tunnels of fans to go through, and this leaves a lot more open road for riders to spread out. Be interested to hear your thoughts or some of the thoughts of your diarist on this. Thanks, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Will. You maybe recorded your question before we had the stages in the Pyrenees, and I think we saw probably bigger crowds there than we expected. Partly, I suspect, because it's close to the Basque Country, and you always get a lot of fans from the Basque Country in the Pyrenees, and they're very passionate, and I think they were bigger than we expected. I asked a couple of our diarists last week whether fewer people made the race feel different, and they tended to say no, because it's the Tour de France, and the biggest sort of thing that affects them is the fact that they're racing against the best riders in the world, and they're all in kind of peak form. This is the race that everybody cares most about and which matters most. And so while on the outside it might look slightly different, on the inside I think it's still the same sort of physical challenge. It's still as competitive, as intense as the Tour de France always is, because it still matters just as much.
And the idea that the spectators might provide some kind of a slipstream because they protect you from winds seems, if you look at the figures in the climbs in this Tour de France, doesn't seem to be the case at all. And also with the cheering, you might think that the cheering can help them out, can help them. Well, they seem to be really going for it, regardless of the cheering or shelter from wind or air. So I don't think it changes lots for them.
The only thing I think it might change is if you have a final climb, summit finish with a light crowd, and they don't crowd in quite so much, because sometimes on the summit finishes they are riding through a corridor wide enough for one rider, which means that the rider in second or third place can't put in an acceleration and go past. So if we saw a summit finish where they're able to race on 5 meters of road instead of a meter and a half of road, we might see, we might see some tactical differences that we perhaps hadn't expected. But we'll have to see what the rest of the mountain stages have in store.
Do you believe there might be a winner for the Tour de France from a country different than Slovenia or Colombia?
Well, thanks, Andres, for your question. Slovenia or Colombia? Richard?
I hadn't thought about it like that, but it's a really good question, isn't it?
Slovenia have got the handicap, haven't they? They've got two chances against... Oh, no, Colombia have got four chances. What am I talking about?
Who might win it that's not from Colombia or Slovenia? My mind's gone blank.
Well, if you look at the GC at the moment, I think the French are the best place, oddly enough, mm-hmm. with Guillaume Martin and Romain Bardet, who are up there in the GC. But for some strange reason, I can't really believe a Frenchman will win the Tour.
We saw Guillaume Martin riding his bike today, didn't he? But he didn't trouble us on the Strava leaderboard. No, he didn't. So I'm not sure what that says about
it. To answer the question, then, we're ruling the French out. Sorry, Francois. Yeah. So,
don't be ridiculous, Francois.
It's Pog and Rog against Bernal, Quintana,
Urán,
and Lopez. I mean, Lopez has got to do some bottle duty after for the Team Colombia here, hasn't he? But I still think Colombia probably. No, Slovenia.
I think Slovenia. No, Colombia.
Hi guys, Keith in Edinburgh here. Like, this might be one for a more in-depth Kilometre Zero investigation, but I've been pretty disappointed by the lack of nicknames for this young crop of pros. In the olden times, you had the Badger, the Cannibal, and there was always ones like King of the Bidons or the Terror of Penzance or something like that. I mean, the only ones I can think of just now are, of course, Superman, Pog, Flying Black Pudding. But why aren't there more? Van Aert doesn't have one. Bernal, Pino, Froome. I can't think of anything for those guys.
Well, Keith, it's a terrific question. Nicknames, they're not as inspired as they used to be. Someone asked us earlier in the week if we could come up with a nickname for Sepp Kuss. Daniel's good at coming up with nicknames. Mm. I think among the nicknames that he's come up with are, he famously came up with the nickname Cuddles for Cadel Evans, which really worked well. Any others? I mean, Pog and Rog, obviously. They're not nicknames, they're just abbreviations of his name.
The Birdman of Bogota for Egan Bernal. I don't know. Does he soar away in the mountains to earn the nickname
Riders
Birdman?
Riders really have to embrace a nickname, I think. You know, I mean, the disgraced Ricardo Rico really embraced his identity as the Cobra, didn't he? There's got to be a sort of, I'm not sure if there's a tongue-in-cheek element to it. I like the Shark, you know, Nibali's kind of embraced that. Riders do have to embrace it, but...
The Librarian for Guillaume Martin, maybe?
The Librarian.
I'm not sure he would,
The professor's already gone because Laurent Fignon was the professor.
Yeah, it was, but I mean, I don't think Laurent Fignon liked to be seen as the professor. He referred more to his glasses than to, an actual, okay, he had his A level as well. So, you know, there you are. No, I don't think Guillaume Martin would be, which we might ask them, you know, within the team they have a nickname, maybe they do.
Well, famously, before the tour, we found out that Team Ineos riders nicknamed Pavel Sivakov Putin.
That's quite good, but I don't see him embracing that, really.
No.
If anybody out there has got good suggestions for nicknames,
any
please.
Rider in the Tour de France and a nickname, tell us on
We've
Twitter.
We've got the goat now, haven't we? Ilner Zakarin is the goat.
Yeah.
We've got the flying pudding. What else?
Nickname suggestions on Twitter, please, @cycling_podcast.
Well. But as I was listening to the question there, it was a sort of question you might perhaps mull over a bottle of wine.
Le vin du jour. À votre santé.
Well, Francois, our wine of the day is the local Chateau Perona.
Well, it's not really local because it's from Blaye. But I mean, I see why it's been picked because on the transfer we did from Pau to La Rochelle, we went past the estuary of La Gironde, where and Blaye is on the northern part of the mouth of. The Gironde, so it's we're in the Bordeaux, area. Now in La Rochelle, that are we're kind of out of the Bordeaux wine region is enormous. It goes nearly from Toulouse to way over Bordeaux. So it's a huge wine area. To be honest, I'm not a great fan of Bordeaux wines. They have a little bit too much tannin for me, and that's the main thing. People who like Bordeaux like the tannin taste.
I was going to say, people who like Bordeaux really love Bordeaux, don't they?
They do, yeah. But it's because of the tannin. Yeah, the tannin is the slightly, it's like with tea. You know, you've got lots of tannin in tea. It gives this kind of a creamy taste to wine. It's quite flattering, but I'm more into fruity wines, so I'm not. But I must say this one, because for once, it's a 13.5. There's not so much alcohol in it. There's no wood. So from time to time, Bordeaux wines are wooded. You know, they put in casks and they have the taste of the. It's very natural, and it's even for a Bordeaux nearly almost fruity. So it's. I'm not a Bordeaux guy, but this is very. I mean,
it's an organic wine, François.
Yeah, it is organic wine, but it is. Well, unless you go, the problem with the Bordeaux wines, for them to be excellent, you need to go to the very top of the league, and then they're out of reach. I mean, in terms of, you know, financially, Mouton Cadet or Mouton Rothschild or Chateau Lafite. I mean, they're wines you'll buy for 100 euros or sometimes more than that, and the bottom of the league in the Bordeaux wines sometimes very disappointing. This is okay.
Well, I'm picking up unoaked flavors of raspberry and cherry fruits with a bit of caramel.
Do you know which package?
This is in the Grand Tour. Well, the big 24-bottle case. It's actually tomorrow's stage wine, this one. And it's part of the collection put together by Greg at Divine Cellars. Thank you very much, Greg. If you want to buy a case of Cycling Podcast wine, they've got green jersey, yellow jersey, different sizes of cases. Go to divinecellars.com.
On with another question.
Hi guys, Mike from Oxford here. Thank you for all the shows that you do. And the question is, what are the rules on jersey design, particularly for the Tour de France? I noticed that the Jumbo-Visma jerseys are predominantly yellow on the back, so you might struggle to distinguish between them and the yellow jersey wearer. So I thought there were rules and regulations that stop that. So if you could explain that to me, that would be most appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Mike. It is a curious one, Jumbo-Visma and their predominant yellow kit. And because in the old days, remember, Onse used to change to a pink kit, didn't they, at the Tour de France? They had a yellow kit.
So did Mercatoni Uno after that.
That's right, yeah. So I don't know what's changed. Have the rules changed? What do you think, François?
I think there are still rules, but if you look closely to the yellow jersey and the Jumbo-Visma jersey is more like lemon yellow, kind of, you know, with greenish shades maybe, and the yellow jersey is far more warm, you know, kind of a warm yellow. So I don't think really, you know, nowadays with the color TV and if you have normal visual disposition, you could mistake one for the other, and also the blue. I mean, the other black and sometimes blue parts of the jersey are big enough, I think, to avoid any confusion. We should actually have a look at the rule book to see whether there are like dimensions or stuff. There might be, but I haven't asked the question.
Or I can ask. I'll ask Jumbo-Visma about that actually, because I have got an interview set up with Richard Plug, the boss there. So I'll ask him about that.
They have got black shoulders, so they when do. They're all leaning forward, you can tell. The one that causes the greater confusion, or did until now, was Primoz Roglic, because he's in a yellow version of the Slovenia champions jersey, which doesn't have the black shoulders. And, my views on that are that the Slovenian champions jersey really ought to be Slovenian
flag
colours. First
man since Merckx to wear the yellow jersey from start to finish, maybe?
Well, quite, exactly. But tomorrow there'll be less confusion because Roglic will be in the yellow jersey. Jumbo-Visma will be in their yellow jerseys.
Does the Slovenian champions jersey pass to Pog?
Well, he's Slovenian time trial champion, I think, Pog.
He is,
À la planche des belles filles.
Well, interesting. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yellow jersey, maybe.
Well, I mean, I'm old school on this. I liked it when Onse had the pink.
UAE, though, don't tend to embrace national champions jerseys to the same extent as some other teams, do they?
When you think of some of the ridiculous rules the UCI does have, protecting the kind of... I understand why the commercial imperative trumps the kind of national tradition, but I do like a proper classic national champions jersey. Do you remember Banesto were one of the first to not really give full respect to the national champions colours? They used to kind of incorporate it in their regular jersey design. I'm not for that at all.
What an honour it was to go cycling with the Irish national champion today.
Well, my jersey was all green, and the Irish champions jersey is white with a green band, which would probably be more distinctive if Sam Bennett didn't ride for De Koenig Quickstep, because again, it's very similar to their regular jersey. But I mean,
you're more in line with Marc Madiot, who's so engrossed by the tricolore, you know, and the bleu, blanc, rouge, the blue, white, and red jersey, that even all his riders wear those colours, whether they're French champions or not, you know. Well, they're French champions almost every year, mind you, but.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport. And if you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, your gels, your bars, your energy bakes, your drinks, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25, SISCP25. That leader's time that I currently boast at the top of the Strava board for the bridge coming back from the Ile de Ré, Lionel, not by accident, because I was fueled on the way home by an orange energy bake and a gel.
Yeah, it was interesting. We were coming up to lunchtime and you turned to me and said, are you feeling hungry? I feel a bit shaky.
A bit wobbly.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were putting the pressure on that point. Bert Grabsch, yep. Sitting there in the front.
40 just, revolutions
just,
per minute.
Yeah, just sitting there with your stomach resting on the top tube and churning around a huge gear. Well, you're getting right down low and aerodynamic.
Okay, okay, nice save. All right. On with the questions.
Hey guys, it's Stan Meir calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in the States. Really appreciate the coverage you're giving to the tour this year with all the difficulties of COVID protocols and getting around, doing a really good job. One question I have for the press conference is regarding Black Lives Matter within the Peloton and within French sporting culture generally. As you're probably aware, the NBA, the players, you know, a week ago or so in protest decided to not do a night's worth of playoff games. In Major League Baseball, you're starting to see managers and players make statements about Black Lives Matter. And so I'm just kind of curious what you might be noticing there, what you're hearing, and be great to just get some perspective on this issue. So thanks again for your coverage and stay safe out there. And I hope you get around safely and that the tour finishes. See you later.
Hi, this is Casey from Portland, Maine in the United States. My question is about the Black Lives Matter movement. Since the return of sports here in the U.S., many athletes and even the leagues themselves have showed their support for the movement. I know some international sports and athletes have also done the same, but I haven't seen anything from the teams or ASO at the Tour de France. I was just curious, since you were there on the ground, if you've seen any support or acknowledgement of the Black Lives Matter movement. Thanks.
Thanks, Casey. And before that, Stan. I mean, this has been a topic that we've talked about on the podcast the last few months a little bit. And I remember, you know, there was a lot of attention on sport and sports people who really did kind of step up when the Black Lives Matter movement burst into the global consciousness, I suppose. And at the time, there was no bike racing. And I remember Daniel saying that he felt that had there been racing on at the time, that cycling would have stepped up too, and we would have heard from riders. Racing has resumed, and perhaps the Black Lives Matter movement isn't as front and center as it was then, but there hasn't been any kind of acknowledgement of it or mention of it, really.
Kevin Rezao is the only black rider in the Tour de France peloton, I think, this year. Was interviewed more than one. I mean, every morning he's interviewed by one of our colleagues on the Black Lives Matter question. He's actually tweeted many times about it at the time. So there is still, you know, you can see an interest in it, and Kevin, you know, in spite of himself, you know, he's standing up and being interviewed about it. But that's about it. I don't think
Well, as you say, he's the only black rider in the race, isn't he? Maybe we should set you that task, Francois. putting you on the spot to talk to Kevin Reza. Morning, because we haven't probably heard his point of view in certainly on the podcast.
I'll do it. Yeah, he's very articulate about it. His position is clear, and he's fortunately or unfortunately very now accustomed to talk about it. And
what I'd like to know from him is what he feels the sport could do to encourage more people from his sort of background into cycling. Yeah.
I think his position about it is that he doesn't think there is at the junior level a real problem for black riders, at least in France, to find their way into the. It's just that there's a lack of interest, he thinks, by young black guys to go into cycling, and they're more tempted to go to other sports, and that's probably the main. But I mean, I don't want to talk in his place, and we'll
It'd be interesting here. I mean, I did an interview the other day with the happy tune the group who are based in Toulouse, in a quite a deprived and racially diverse area. And they bring young kids on the Tour de France every year, and they produce a radio show and a magazine. And they're one of the two good causes that we're supporting this year through the sale of Stacey Snyder's mugs and cups. And incidentally, another batch of those will go on sale sometime soon. She's currently making them, but we'll play that interview as well at some point, because they're based in a quite a deprived part of Toulouse, where a Tour de France stage began last year, and that seems to be a cause that the Tour has embraced, and it's a mutual embrace, and they're doing their bit, I think, to bring other people from different backgrounds into cycling and into the Tour de France through a different way, you know, through the media. So they had some interesting things to say, and we will hear from them in a future episode.
Hi chaps, Stephen Fortune here, friend of the podcast from the UK. My question for you is, why wouldn't De Koenig Quickstep go all in for Alain Philippe to have the first French winner of the Tour de France for decades? Surely this opportunity to be legends in perpetuity overrides all other ambitions. What are your thoughts?
Hello, Richard, Lionel and Francois. This is Andy Gladstone from New York. Thank you very much again for your daily coverage. It's keeping me occupied and happy and smiling in my daily commute into New York City every day. Regarding Julian Alaphilippe and his mental state currently, on stage four, he let Guillaume Martin take the podium. If you look, it looks like he held up right at the line and Guillaume was able to cross third. Then the tantrum he threw in this stage, where he was cut off and sacrificed many spots in the end result. And obviously the bottle mishap, is knowing that he had lost his father and that he's very emotional, but what preparation did he do during the coronavirus period? And is his head all there, or is he distracted by other things? He seems to be a distracted rider at this moment. I'd like to know what your thoughts are. Thank you again very much for the coverage. Look forward to every day's episodes.
Thanks, Stephen and Andy. Two questions about Julian Alaphilippe there. I mean, I've said a few times that I don't think he's quite the same rider that he was last year. And I suppose I wonder whether he went so deep at the Tour de France last year in trying to hold on to that yellow jersey. I'm not suggesting permanent damage was done, but he's not been quite the same rider since then, with flashes of brilliance, obviously. I think Milan-San Remo and up the Col d'Aise in Nice, we saw, you know, the old Alaphilippe, but he's not appeared to me to be quite the same rider that he was last year.
I think that's obvious. He's had a few health issues. Well, he lost his father, which is obviously a blow psychologically, especially during the coronavirus crisis. I think it's very difficult for a rider to stay at the level he was last year, and with a kind of winning everything, and you know, all of a sudden finding himself in a position of a Tour de France contender. My impression is that last year was exceptional. Not that this year is any different from what he's worth. It actually, he won a stage, won the yellow jersey, took the yellow jersey, which is already a huge task accomplished for a rider of his caliber. He showed in Milan-San Remo what the kind of rider he really is, which is a classics rider. And I think the focus for him on the GC and the Tour de France, and changing his approach to it, his diet, trying to get lighter and train more in the mountain, would actually probably spoil his talent, and there are many chances that he would fail, and in the meantime probably fail also to win other races he could win. A counter example could be Romain Bardet, who I think did very well in the Tour many times, but would probably never win it, and could have, and that's what he decided to do, could go for Strade Bianche or Liège and win those races as well. So maybe another factor is that, as we see, you know, every day, every 2 years, you have new young talent, and Alaphilippe is now not among the old guys of the peloton, but when you've got guys of 22, 21, younger than he is, coming up so quickly, maybe in the same, you know, registry as Alaphilippe, a guy like Wout van Aert is going for the same kind of races, is the same type of riders, only a little better, and that might affect, you know, the Alaphilippe's results.
And he's in a team that wants to win often, would probably prioritise 4 or 5 stage wins in the tour over a kind of a distant shot at the overall. And he's not in a team that is built to defend a yellow jersey or support a GC rider. I mean, when was the last time we saw Dries Devenins early in the race, some help on the climbs, but it's not a team built for a GC contender at all, to Koenig Quickstep, and they've got other fish to fry, so to speak. Sam Bennett still aiming for a stage win, a good shout for a challenge in the green jersey as well, and they've got a lot on their plate, the Koenig Quickstep. And so Alaphilippe last year was the cherry, the icing sugar on the cherry on the top of the cake, really, wasn't it? No one really expected him to go so long into the tour still in the yellow jersey and finish so high overall as he did. And expecting that to happen again this year, I think, was a tall order. And I don't think there's any value to Alaphilippe to move to another team to throw its entire weight behind him for a Tour de France challenge, because I think it would require him to focus on it almost to the exclusion of everything else. And for a rider of Alaphilippe's, multiple talents, I don't think there's any point.
As well. I mean, he's somebody who I think people really enjoy watching him race, because he seems to ride on emotion and passion. And, you know, that's what carried him, I think, so far in last year's Tour de France.
Well, we saw that, didn't we, in the mountains here. Yeah. He made that a last swashbuckling final.
And of course he
attack.
Might and arguably should have been in the yellow jersey. And you know, he's lost time now and he'll go for a stage win. But had he not lost the yellow jersey in those kind of curious circumstances, would he still be in the yellow jersey now? Maybe. Because what we saw last year was, when he was in that yellow jersey, he was able to fight tooth and nail to keep it. Without being in it, his desire seemed slightly less. But I think there's something kind of slightly lacking as well at the moment physically.
My impression as well is that the level in this Tour de France, maybe because the feel, and maybe because it comes straight after the coronavirus crisis, my impression is that the level is a little bit higher than last year as well, the general level. If you look at the figures, I know they don't mean much, but and maybe you know,
the figures over the Ile de Ré bridge today, Francois.
So, what I mean is that probably Alaphilippe, was in a position last year to compete at the same level, almost at the same level as the GC contenders, but now they've gone a gear up, and it's a little bit too high for him.
Possibly. Before we go tonight, thanks very much to all of you for your questions. We had a lot of written questions as well. Thanks for them. We did prioritise the audio questions because we do like to hear your voice. So we'll do another press conference on the next rest day. Please send in your questions by audio if you can, and we'll get through as many of them as we can. I think we were expecting some questions about things going on away from the race, but maybe nobody's interested in anything going on away
from
the race.
The tour is a tour, isn't it? It kind of gobbles
up
absolutely everything.
Well, I thought of a new twist on that, actually, Lionel. The tour is not the tour. This year. It's just a bit different, isn't
Radical.
It?
Radical. Radical stuff.
Could be a t-shirt. But before we go, a couple of reminders. One is Kilometre Zero comes out every weekday morning, Monday to Friday. Today's episode was remembering Nico Portal, the sports director who died in March, aged just 40. And we've got some very moving interviews with Dave Brailsford, Fran Miller, Vincent Lavenue, and Pavel Sivakov in that episode. And coming up, we've got more installments of the Audio Diarists. And we've got a couple of other special episodes this week. Kilometre Zero is supported by Zwift. Thank you very much indeed to them. And if you want to become a friend of the podcast, lots of people have been signing up, maybe just discovering the cycling podcast during the Tour de France. But if you sign up as a friend of the podcast, you'll get exclusive episodes, sort of documentary style episodes, different things. They are exclusive to friends of the podcast if you sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. We'll be back tomorrow with stage 10. We'll be in Ile de Ré. First time ever Tour de France been to Ile de Ré, which is surprising, really. But we'll be there. In the meantime, thank you very much, Francois.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.